Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to the New Books Network. My name is Ren Veith, and I'm a host on the Human Rights Channel. Today, we have Frederick Schauer here to discuss his new book, The Proof, Uses of Evidence in Law, Politics, and Everything Else. Frederick Schauer is a David and Mary Harrison Distinguished Professor of Law at the University of Virginia. Thanks for coming on the show, Fred.
I'm delighted to be here, delighted to talk about the book, and grateful that you're giving me the opportunity.
So to start, I'm curious how you came to write this book in the first place. What brought you to this project?
Sure. So there's the sort of long term and short term what brought me to this project. The long term is that a long time ago, before my about 45 years as an academic, I was a trial lawyer. So I dealt with evidence on a daily basis. Evidence is something that was a big part of my professional life when I was, let's call it, real lawyer. But I've been an academic for 40 plus years, but because I started as a trial lawyer, for at least much of that 40 plus years, I have been teaching the law of evidence to law students. I also teach constitutional law with a subspecialty of free speech and free press. But evidence has been one of the things that I have been teaching and writing about for a long time. So short term, in addition to my more abstruse work about evidence and evidence theory and so on, short term, I was inspired, I'm not sure that's the right word, but inspired by some of the rhetoric that surrounded the last presidential election in the U.S. And a lot of that rhetoric was about evidence, and a lot of the counter rhetoric, appropriately, was about evidence. That is, people, when Trump and others were claiming that there was election fraud, some number of political figures and commentators, including political figures from his own party, were saying things like, "Where is the evidence?" And it was interesting the extent to which a demand for evidence and a demand for proof became part of the rhetoric in ways that it is not always the case. And then this was reinforced on January the 6th, 2021, where there were big disputes about who said what to whom and when did they say it and why did they say it. That's all about evidence. So that led me to want to do something more systematic about evidence, combined with the extent to which evidentiary issues were front and center as people debated about vaccines and the effectiveness of vaccines. So it was not just alleged election fraud. It was not just the riots at the Capitol, but issues like vaccination and so on were all about evidence. And that led me to think that there were so many evidentiary issues that were worth trying to somewhat loosely bring together in a book. So that's the background, and that's the book.
So I don't usually ask this particular question, but I'm curious about your envisioned audience for this book. Part of why I'm asking this is the question of who the audience might be for this is because I've read a number of law books, and I found yours incredibly accessible, which I mean as a very high compliment, and also unfortunately, as you just nodded to, very I don't know, very appropriate to the current moment. So I would be curious to hear who your envisioned audience is.
Right. So I think the audience is what I would want to think of as the educated and intellectually interested layperson, not lawyers, not very much lawyers, a little bit philosophers who think about philosophy of science and related evidentiary issues, a little bit academics in various non-law, non-philosophy disciplines who think about evidence as they think about history, as they think about facts, and so on. But mostly, it is the educated and intellectually interested public. So that's the audience. It's not in the audience that sort of, I don't know how to describe this, reads the most serious newspapers or the ones that the most serious news magazines or access the most serious forms of general news and general commentary.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear you say that, you know, it's not for lawyers. Just in reading, I mean, that I noticed it was, I don't know, there was a lot of contextualization, a lot of history, there's a lot of philosophy, a lot of different things really woven throughout.
Yeah, and it's, I think part of the motivation for the book is that despite what you just said, which I agree with, I think it's also the case that although people make fun of the rules of evidence, and people make fun of lawyers when they are engaged in litigation, the law of evidence and the rules of evidence have a fair amount to teach other people when they think about evidence. So sometimes what the law does not carry over, but sometimes it does. And at least as you read, some of this book is about what can the law teach the rest of us as we think about evidence. So yes, it's appropriate to make fun of the law. It's appropriate to make fun of the rules of evidence, but there's a little bit of a there. And I think other disciplines and people can learn from it.
So to shift perhaps a little bit away from the law just for a moment, a really interesting thread that I enjoyed in the proof that you're thinking through is that you make it clear that that we're facing different questions around evidence. So there's the question of what evidence is as a particular category, what it means, and all of that. But also there's this question of what we should do with it. And I would love to hear you speak a little bit to this, because I appreciated how clear that was when you were laying everything out.
Sure. So it's a nice question. You put it better than I put it in the book. But I think one way of thinking about this, which again draws a little bit on the law, is what do we count as evidence in the first place? So the reason that I say it draws a little bit on the law is that in the typical trial, at least in the typical trial in the common law system. So I realize that this is an odd way to put it, given that I am speaking to someone who is speaking from a from a civil law jurisdiction. But in the typical common law trial involving a jury, there are two very important steps. One step is what counts as admissible or usable evidence in the first place. The judge has to decide, is this something that we're going to take into account? And then once the jury has, once the judge has decided what counts, then the trier of fact, typically the jury in a common law system, has to decide what to do with it. Those two steps occur in almost every use of evidence. What's the evidence out there? And then what's, what does the evidence add up to? How do we make a decision on the basis of that evidence? And at least one of the running themes of the book, is that first of all evidence is probabilistic. We should not think of something as certain or not. Evidence is probabilistic. And even more importantly, what we are going to do with the evidence is very much a function of what turns on it. What are the stakes? What are the consequences? So it is common to think, if we think in terms of the criminal law, or even the televised version of the criminal law, which may not bear very much relationship to what actually goes on. But one of the things that's true about the criminal law is that we don't put people in prison unless there is proof beyond a reasonable doubt. Not quite absolute, no doubt about it, certainty, but pretty close. But for lots of other things, we don't have that much evidence, and we don't want that much evidence, and we don't need that much evidence. So a somewhat vivid example I use is suppose you hear from a couple of different slightly reliable but not absolutely certain sources that the person that you have hired as a babysitter has issues with child molestation. There's no absolute proof. There's no proof beyond a reasonable doubt, but you have a responsibility to a child. Under those circumstances, I would suspect that most people, I won't talk to myself since I have no children, but most people would say that strong suspicion or some evidence or good evidence, even if it is not proof beyond a reasonable doubt, is going to be sufficient to say, no, I'd rather have someone else as a babysitter. I'd rather have someone else involved in child care. It's a somewhat offensive but maybe vivid example of the fact that how much evidence we want is very much a function of what turns on it. And that, as I said, relates to the fact that all evidence is probabilistic. And one consequence of all evidence being probabilistic is that for some purposes, what we might think of as weak evidence or insufficient evidence might still be sufficient for some particular purpose.
So that's a your response there is a wonderful segue to my next question. My research field sites, one of them is the asylum tribunals in the UK, where certainty over asylum applications and evidence is a major topic. And so I really, really appreciated that you gave so much time to thinking about certainty and evidence. And so you did already, you know, allude to a bit, you know, this idea of reasonable doubt. But I also appreciated that you flagged that it can be really difficult to think about these things, or perhaps impossible in terms of numerical probability. So I would be curious to hear a little bit more about how, how doubt fits into evidence.
Right. Although the law uses the phrase reasonable doubt, in some sense, there's always doubt. We're never absolutely sure. There's always doubt. To take the example of what you are researching about and what you are writing about, I don't know very much about asylum law, but I read the newspapers. So one way of thinking about an asylum application is, should we grant this person asylum? Who says that if they are required to go back to where they have most recently been, they will be subject to torture, their family will be subject to torture, all sorts of horrible things will happen. Under those circumstances, my instinct, obviously guided or influenced by my own moral views, my own politics, or whatever, is that if you are in a relatively safe, developed country, and someone from a country in the midst of great turmoil is an applicant for asylum, I would want something less than proof beyond a reasonable doubt of the likely consequences should their application be denied. So to put it in numbers, sometimes it's useful to put it in rough numbers, even if we can't nail it down. If there is a 80% chance that denying an asylum application will subject this person to and this person's family to inconceivable torture, 80% would be good enough for me. I don't know what the UK does. I don't know what Canada does. Actually, I'm not even sure in terms of percentages what the US does. But if it were my decision, 80% would be good enough for me, given that the consequences are serious torture or worse for the person for whom we deny an application. So it's a good example. It's a good example of the way in which these issues come up all the time, and a good example of the fact that in almost every area in which we are concerned about facts, the real issue is, what are the consequences if some claim about facts are true? What are the consequences if some claim about facts are false? So to continue with the same example that you just gave me, suppose you get it wrong. Or suppose the asylum board or whoever makes the decision gets it wrong. If the asylum board gets it wrong, the worst thing that happens is that somebody from an impoverished country gets to live in a comparatively wealthy country of 60 million people. That's not the worst thing in the world. That's a lot worse than somebody being tortured. So even if the asylum board is making its decision on the basis of 80% probability, if they get it wrong, that's okay. And indeed, that's the idea that William Blackstone was talking about 200 and some years ago, when he said, it is better that 10 guilty people go free than that one innocent person be punished. And this kind of, let's call it a calculus in the loosest sense, this kind of calculus comes up in almost every evidentiary determination. So if you'll let me give another example from another part of the book, one of the things I talk about in the book, because it's an interest of mine, is art authentication. When I say art authentication, I am not talking about art evaluation. I am not talking about whether Picasso was a better painter than Monet and whether Monet was a more important artist than Rembrandt. I am talking instead about the enormously important field of is a work of art, especially a work of art by a non-living artist, what it purports to be. So there have been lots of recent disputes about whether something allegedly a Vermeer or allegedly a Leonardo actually was painted by Vermeer or actually was painted by Leonardo. And making these determinations invariably are evidentiary determinations and invariably, again, involve the question of what turns on it. So suppose in a counterfactual world that you have a Leonardo on your wall. You're not quite sure whether it's a real Leonardo, but you think it is. And you engage in some effort to determine whether it is or not. And the ultimate conclusion is it probably is, but you can't be sure. My guess is that you would keep it on the wall. Because if it turns out that ultimately it's not a real Leonardo, to put it somewhat bluntly, so what? Now let's change the facts a little bit. Let's say that you are Sotheby's or Christie's auction house, and there's a question whether the work of art that you are selling as a Leonardo or a Botticelli or a Vermeer or whatever is challenged, and someone says it's not a real one. Now, if you're the chief authenticator at Christie's, you want to be absolutely sure, because the consequences to Christie's of selling as a Leonardo something that's not a real Leonardo is much greater than the consequences to you of having something on your wall that you and your friends think is Leonardo, but that is actually not. So once again, what turns on it? The art authentication disputes are, for me, fascinating. Sometimes they are amusing. There's actually the one about Vermeer that I talk about in the book was the subject of a book and a movie. It's an amusing example. This art forger named Han van Mergeren, who was Dutch, painted some number of Vermeers in the 1930s. He convinced some number of experts, some number of museums, and some number of collectors, including the most famous collector of the time, Hermann Göring, that I'm not sure collector is the right word for Göring, acquirer, let us say, convinced some number of these people that the Vermeers that he painted, including some that had not yet been discovered, allegedly, were real Vermeers. The And some number of them were sold. Some number of them were in museums. Fast forward 7 or 8 years, World War II ends. And von Magerin is charged with the crime of treason because he had allegedly sold his or sold part of the Dutch provenance, Dutch artistic history, to Goering and others. Here's the amusing part, at least to me. His defense was, you can't charge me as a traitor because I am not a traitor. I am a forger. That is, I didn't sell a real Vermeer because it's not a real Vermeer. I painted it and I can prove it to you. And he, in fact, proved it to you by off the cuff painting a little bit of a Vermeer in front of the judges who were making this decision. So he was ultimately convicted as a forger, but not as a traitor. The penalty was much less. He actually didn't serve very much of it because he died, but that's a backstory. But these issues come up all the time in art authentication. They come up all the time in history. A very big dispute in the U.S., now mostly resolved, is was Thomas Jefferson the father of the children of an enslaved person in his household named Sally Hemings? And lots of people invested a lot of time and money and psychological energy on both sides of this issue. The current expert consensus is that yes, he was, but a lot of people got angry on both sides of this. Once again, Sally Hemings is dead. Thomas Jefferson is dead. And making this determination, as with most historical determinations, involves evaluating competing bits of non-certain evidence.
Thank you so much for all of that. And as a note in terms of asylum determinations in the UK, it's supposed to just be likely. It's supposed to be much lower, right, than reasonable doubt. But that's a, I don't know, story for another time. Throughout the book, and also when we began, you made allusions to contemporary things like the Trump allegations of election fraud, which is an accusation that has no evidence behind it, as you note multiple times, right? And right. I was really struck by your statement. Yeah. I was struck by your statement in the preface that all too frequently, for example, commentators on a variety of issues conflate the lack of evidence with falsity, taking the absence of evidence as being equivalent to evidence that the statement is false. And so I would love to hear you speak a bit to what a lack of evidence actually signifies, because I haven't seen that emphasized as clearly as it was in your book.
Right. So the way I put it in the book is we should not confuse the absence of evidence with evidence of absence. That is, the fact that we don't know something doesn't mean that we know that it's not true. And therefore we ought to be very careful to distinguish uncertainty. We just have no evidence from certainty that something that is claimed is just not true. So, I'll use the example, from the book that you talk about. Trump claims that there was lots of election fraud. For the first couple days that he made that claim, there was no evidence, and therefore we just didn't know. After some days and weeks and months of investigation, we came to the conclusion, or most thoughtful people came to the conclusion, there was no fraud. That is, it wasn't just that there was no evidence, but the claims of fraud were false. There was actually no fraud. And in numerous different areas, it is important to distinguish what we don't know from what we know to be false. That's what I mean when I say that there is a difference between the absence of evidence and evidence of absence. And one related area in which this comes up all the time, it's one of my pet peeves that comes up all the time in the book, is what I call in the book the tyranny of adjectives. That is, often we, especially in political and public debate, people will say there's no direct evidence of something. There's no conclusive evidence for something. There's no concrete evidence for something. If you hear that, all of a sudden the signal flags or warning flags ought to go up. When somebody says there's no concrete evidence of X, what they're really saying is there's some evidence of X. There's no conclusive evidence of X. They're saying there's some evidence of X. And the reason I call it the tyranny of adjectives is that the person who is saying, well, there's no concrete evidence of something. Just like to give an example, in the 1950s and 1960s, the tobacco companies were fond of saying, there's no conclusive evidence that cigarette smoking is harmful. In that context, what they really are doing is building in a very high burden of proof for which there may be no justification. They are trying to seduce you into thinking that there is no evidence for something, even though there is some evidence for something. So whenever you see the no concrete evidence, no direct evidence, no conclusive evidence, you ought to be on your guard, just like you ought to be on your guard when people say in various public statements, the evidence is only circumstantial. Complaining about circumstantial evidence is a favorite tactic of, let us say, lawyers for guilty defendants. Almost all evidence in one form or another is circumstantial. And almost all non-circumstantial evidence is not as good as we often think it is. We know from a lot of recent events and a lot of recent psychological and criminological studies that so-called eyewitness testimony can often be mistaken, that what we see is not always what actually happened. So thinking that circumstantial evidence is suspect for that reason is a mistake. Thinking that non-circumstantial evidence is absolutely certain is also a mistake.
So building on your wonderful response to that question, something else that I really appreciated in terms of engaging with certain kinds of uncertainties around evidence, your points about skepticism, in particular, how skepticism can go beyond what's reasonable. And I'm thinking in particular about skepticism as a particular kind of evidence as, as verifiable, as reliable, as usable, et cetera, et cetera. So I would be curious to hear you speak a little bit to, I guess what I would call maybe reactionary skepticism to certain kinds of evidence.
Okay, right. So it's I think this relates to a little bit what we were talking about a few minutes ago about uncertain evidence. I think there is a tendency, and maybe it's more common in some fields than others, to take the absence of certainty or the absence of verification as indicating that There is no truth to be had. There is no truth to be discovered. There is no there there. I am not, to use a fancy term, I am not an epistemological skeptic. I believe that there is truth and falsity in the world. I believe that there are some things that are right and some things that are wrong. I believe that most of us believe that. And the kind of skepticism we may see in some corners of some academic disciplines, that there's no truth, there's no knowledge, there are no facts, is not something that I am comfortable with. Now, that said, I am comfortable with recognizing that it is appropriate to be skeptical at times about how we know what we know. And we ought not to confuse the fact that we may not be certain about what we know from the fact that there's no truth and there's no knowledge. Being careful and thoughtful about evidence may help us approach truth, may help us approach knowledge, even if we can never be absolutely certain. And thinking that because we are not absolutely certain means that we don't have any knowledge or that there is no truth is a mistake. I want to guard against that. So to put it in, I'm not a global skeptic, and the book is not a globally skeptic book.
I'm thinking about some of the points you raise throughout the book in terms of, right, like this very basic question of, you know, what do we do with evidence? What can evidence tell us? What's the context? All of these really big questions. And a few places you highlight this thread of assumption that we all have that draws upon past action, past evidence, and makes that link to future action. This isn't asking, you know, how evidence can predict the future. But what do you see as the limits on evidence, including things like federal judicial limits, as you highlight from the past as proof of the future?
Right. Good. So this may be the main area in which what the law does is appropriate for the law, but it does not and should not carry over to our everyday evidentiary determinations. So the law, at least the common law, the law in its, Anglo-American judicial context, tends to be very skeptical of what it calls character evidence, and very skeptical about the ability to use past acts as proof that someone did or did not do something now. If you are charged with a crime, say you are charged with bank robbery, and say you have been convicted three times in the past of being a bank robber, in the U.S., and in most other common law systems, the jury will never find out about your past bank robberies. In ordinary determination, that's nuts, to use the appropriate technical term. We make these determinations all the time. We predict the future, and we also make decisions under circumstances of uncertainty based on what we know about the past and the relevance of the past to the future. It's all entirely rational. If, to use an example I use in the book, if you have an acquaintance who on four occasions has been convicted of reckless driving, and at the end of some party or event, this person says to you, "Do you want a ride?" I hope that you're going to think twice about saying, "Sure, I'd be happy to have you give me a ride." That's entirely rational. The law excludes all of this for a reason, for a bunch of reasons that are at least rational for the law. One of them is that the law is worried that although this is valuable evidence in terms of predicting the future or making decisions under uncertainty right now, the law is worried that people or juries will overvalue it. They'll take it as conclusive, even though it might be good but not conclusive evidence. So the law, for lots of good reasons, that goes back a little bit to Blackstone and all of this, the law says it is better to undervalue this evidence, then overvalue it. We are worried that juries are going to overvalue it. We are worried that juries are going to take what is good evidence as conclusive. So in order to guard against overvaluation, we command that the juries undervalue it by not letting them hear about it in the first place. In addition, the law, for good moral reasons, believes that people ought to be evaluated on a case-by-case basis. And the law, for good moral reasons, believes that people ought to be given, let's call it, second chances. You know, we all... we've all seen these bad movies where someone is convicted of some crime. They serve time in the penitentiary. They are then released and nobody gives him a job. And he complains, "Nobody gives me a job. I've already paid my debt to society. I want someone to give me a second chance or give me a new chance." The law, for lots of good reasons, thinks that this is an admirable goal, that you pay your penalty, you serve your sentence, or whatever the penalty is, and then you ought to be entitled to start over again. That may not be the wisest thing to do in everyday decision-making about who to take a ride from or which merchant to trust and so on, or to take a particularly vivid example from the recent news. Are you going to buy securities from the people who have been involved in the most recent events regarding crypto sales? Now, I'm not even sure what a crypto is. The only thing I'm sure about is I don't have any. Are you going to buy securities from the people who've been involved in all of this? And I think many of us, including myself, would say no. Entirely rational decision based on past acts or even based on past accusations, but there are good reasons why the law would not want to do this, and good reasons why many of us in many contexts would not want to do what the law does, just as there are good reasons for the law doing what the law does.
So the last question that I have for you about your book, you use climate change as an example in a number of places throughout the proof in terms of an example that something we have information from scientists, we have evidence from scientists, but we don't necessarily know how to get to that that ideal cutback on fossil fuels, and also thinking in terms of something that has been framed as politics, thinking of the Coney Barrett questioning that you you nod to, as well as thinking about an idea of expert consensus. And I know that climate change is front of mind for many. Perhaps this is in part because I'm in Montreal, which was the site of COP15, COP15. So I would love to hear how you see climate change as an example of all of these big questions of evidence being tied together, because that seemed, I don't know, really clear to me. And I appreciated this this thread throughout.
Yeah, good. Okay, so I mean, one of the interesting things about climate change is that for those of us who believe it is real, we don't actually know why we believe it's real, other than we rely on the experts. Especially maybe over the last couple of years, we've seen examples of it. But the mechanisms of climate change involve scientific expertise that's totally beyond my comprehension. I rely on experts. And then there's... But then there's the problem of how do non-experts know who the experts are and who they're not? Some of that is based on credentials. I rely on the fact that people win Nobel Prizes or things of that sort, or they have fancy university positions in scientific disciplines. But all of this is indirect. And I think in many scientific areas, it's essential that we rely on experts, but it becomes increasingly essential that we think carefully about who the experts are and how we know who the experts are, especially in an area in which everybody is an expert about something. So one of the things I mention in the book in the chapter on expertise is that there are people these days who claim to be lifestyle experts. I don't know what a lifestyle expert is. I'm not sure the people who claim to be lifestyle experts know what a lifestyle expert is. But there are experts in climate change, in physics, in meteorology, in chemistry, and so on. I rely on them. I hope justifiably, but what I'm doing when I rely on them is aggregating different credentials from different areas and relying on various different credentialing organizations or institutions or whatever. Now, one of the things that happens in this particular debate is what I end the book with, and a couple of people, more than a couple, have accused me of ending this book on a depressing note. The last chapter of the book, which draws pretty heavily on some modern cognitive and social psychology, is about motivated reasoning. So motivated reasoning is the phenomenon well-researched by cognitive and social psychologists, by which, according to which people often make factual determinations about which there are factual answers based on their normative, moral, and political preferences. The phenomenon is familiar to all of us who are sports fans. Did the ball go over the line or not? We all know that depending on which team you root for will be a determinant of whether you think the ball went over the line or not, even though there's there is entirely a factual matter. If I am a fan of in deference to where you're located, let's say the puck go over the line or not. If you are a fan of the Chicago Blackhawks, and the question is whether the Canadian scored or not, you have an interest in the puck not having gone over the line, and you really believe that it didn't go over the line, just as Canadiens fans will think that it really did. That's motivated reasoning. I say this with some trepidation, although there are things in the world that are more important than hockey, like climate change, for example. The same phenomenon exists throughout all of this. We saw this in the U.S. about how people evaluated the events of January the 6th, 2021. Overwhelmingly, people on one side of the political divide made entirely factual statements or reached entirely factual conclusions based on their political preferences, even though there was a fact of the matter. This happens so often. This is such a pervasive phenomenon that it casts doubt on our ability to, let us say, objectively evaluate evidence. And that's why I end the book on this somewhat depressing note.
Well, thank you so much for your time today. At least for me, I don't think it ends on a depressing note. I really enjoyed reading it. I found it incredibly engaging. And so thank you so much for speaking with me about The Proof. Before we close for today, would you like to let listeners know about other projects that you might be working on?
So I remain interested in evidence generally, and want to do more. And I'm thinking about doing a little bit more on, and it relates to the climate change issue, evidence in public policy, rather than just evidence about what happened or what didn't, evidence like whether it be climate change or the harmfulness of various substances. I'm interested in all of that, but I also work in my legal theorist domain. I am working on and continue to work on questions of legal sources, but also, and it relates a little bit more to evidence, as someone who thinks occasionally skeptically or more than occasionally skeptically about freedom of expression. I am interested in the question and work on it and write about it. Does debate and freedom of expression incline towards truth? John Milton, 300 and some years ago, said, "Whoever knew truth put to the worse in a fair fight with falsehood." I'm not sure Milton was right. And I continue to think about the extent to which letting everybody say whatever they want inclines towards truth or inclines towards knowledge. So that's about evidence, too, when it relates to what this book is all about. So thank you very much. This has been lots of fun. I hope people read the book. I hope they engage with it. I hope they disagree with it.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.